task and pleasure to you. As mentioned, I apologize for my strange accent. It's very strong American, and I'll try to talk slow. You know, I've traveled extensively, particularly to Australia, and while there, I try to pick up their accent, because I was really excited to meet you. And, you know, I tried, but I got this, I got G'day. And I practiced, but you know, standing in line, you know, going through immigration, I said, G'day. And then I do it, and then before even handing them my passport, they say, good try, Mike. Not quite that. Keep right. Okay, today I'm going to talk to you about the cosmic distance ladder. It's probably the most important thing that astronomers do, the cosmic distance ladder. It's also a great excuse to show you a lot of beautiful pictures. So you're going to be blasted with that. I hope you don't mind. Astronomy is all about beauty, I think. That's why I'm in the business. So the cosmic distance ladder, a little bit like this cartoon here, we're going to go one rung at a time to figure out the scale of the universe. It's incredibly difficult, and it's kind of amazing that we can do it at all. But over the years, over the decades, since really Hubble's time, almost 100 years ago now, this is what we've been doing, one rung at a time until we get out to the edge of the universe. So I'm going to go over that, how we do it. And but first, I'm going to show you some results that come from the cosmic distance ladder. First off, let me just give you a little definition. It's a succession of empirical scientific methods by which astronomers determine the distances to celestial objects. That's very straightforward. We do things like radar ranging. You may have already heard about that, remote sensing. We do things like parallax, trigonometric parallax, and we measure stars, and we can sort things out from that. We look at variable stars. They tell us something about distance. Then we use more advanced methods to look at distant galaxies. And finally, to look at the very most distant galaxies in the universe, we'll use Hubble's law. Okay, so let's keep going. The reason we have to do this is to, you know, make sense of the universe. We absolutely cannot figure things out once we know the distance to the object. Otherwise, we're like this fellow from a woodcut in the Middle Ages. We look out into the heavens, and it looks like a dizzying array of, you know, of stuff. The heavens is very complex. But once we can figure out the distances, the scale of the universe, it starts to make sense. Okay, the cosmic distance ladder gives you three important things. If you know the distance, you can get the luminosity, okay, the intrinsic brightness of the object. That's absolutely crucial. Without that, you don't know how far away the sun is. You don't know if the sun's just a ball of fire. You know, you need to know how its luminosity, obviously geometry, size, and shape. And finally, the scale of the universe. These are the fundamental things that distance gives you. Okay, so I'm going to break up my talk into sort of three sections. Start off with the elegant universe, and this is where I'm going to show you what we've done with our cosmic distance ladder. And then I will talk about the various distance methods from here to eternity. And finally, I'll end with the cosmic web, the big picture, which is what I like to work on. It's my favorite subject. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. And let's start with the elegant universe. One of my favorite pictures is this one. This is from New Zealand. And on a dark, starry night, maybe the moon's down, you can step out. Where I grew up in Idaho, it was really dark there. I could step out in my backyard and it would be thousands of stars. In California, I wouldn't. The there's no way of doing that, but you can go up into the mountains and you can see this. In New Zealand, you see thousands and thousands of stars. But you start to notice that they're not just, you know, random. You see patterns. You know, you see this pattern, everybody knows what those three stars are. It's Orion, right? And then everybody here knows what these are. It's the Magellanic Clouds. Now, if I were to show this picture in the Northern Hemisphere, I thought, everybody's kind of going, I'm not sure what those things are. You can't see them from the north. Those are the beautiful Magellanic Clouds. And you should know what that is. You know, those aren't clouds. That's the Milky Way. It's a little bit too close on the horizon. So we've seen all kinds of interesting stuff up there. It's very beautiful. Northern Hemisphere, let's say you're out in the desert in Arizona, this is what you might see. Looking up through one of the Joshua tree or something, you see the northern Milky Way. This looks like Cygnus to me. It's very beautiful. But you notice that it seems to have some interesting structure in there. There's some dark lanes. There's a little blob here. What are those? How far away are they? How big are they? You see patterns in the sky. This is something like, I can see this from my backyard in California. It's the Big Dipper. It's the easiest constellation to see from the northern hemisphere. Can't see it at all from down here in the south. But that's okay. You have far more interesting constellations than the north does. This is the one. Here's the Big Dipper. It's got a name. Big Dipper's like a big ladle made in space. Holding something, holding, you know, milk. It's got this pattern that reminds me of the ancient peoples that it looked like something. Looks like the Great Bear, Ursa Major. This is the constellation of Ursa Major. It's a big bear. This is its tail right here. A bear with its tail.
So could we dim the lights a bit?
Yeah, dim lights, yeah. Good point, because we're coming up to the real colorful, spectacular pictures. Get it. Various permutations. Other way. There we go. There's the Big Dipper. Now it's right. The Big Dipper. Ursa Major. So to some people look like a great bear in the sky. To the Chinese, it looked like a bureaucrat, pushing a wheelbarrow through space. It's a pattern of stars. What exactly is that? You know, astronomers today know that that's just a projection of stars. If you were to actually fly to them, they would start to spread out. They would change their shape completely. It wouldn't look like a Big Dipper. A little bit further north, the sky is going to change on order of seconds. See these shimmering, you know, what's that? These are the northern lights, the aurora borealis. There's the equivalent in the southern hemisphere. So these are cosmic rays coming from the sun, right? The sun is spewing cosmic rays. These are charged particles, electrons, photons. It's flying through space and it passes over Earth. And Earth, thank God we have a magnetosphere, otherwise we'd be fraud. Goes through the poles, and comes right down, and you see fluorescence from that. Very beautiful. Back to the southern hemisphere, this is a great picture. I like to think of this as humanity. Here's some human statues. Humanity stirring up into the heavens, which can, you know, only be described as the elegant and sublime universe. Most beautiful picture. Okay, so now I want to take a little stroll through the universe. We're going to start nearby. Let's start with our closest neighbor, which is the moon. There's the moon. And, you know, this is part of folklore from time forgotten. The moon is so close that you can see features on it. You can name things on there. You can see craters. And you can see actual mountains. And if you have a little telescope, which was, you know, coming around the 17th century, you can start to notice at least that there's crater, that there are mountains and there's valleys, and it really starts to remind you of Earth. It's another little world, the moon. So we know that the moon is nearby. It only takes a few days to get there via a chemical rocket. You know, we've been there. Easy peasy, right? Well, that was a long time ago, and it's not that easy to get there. But here's our closest neighbor. And, you know, there's some We astronomers like to use the moon to figure out what happened in the past. It's a bit of a time machine because it's got all these great craters on it. And there was a time in some 4 billion years ago when the moon and the Earth were being pummeled by asteroids and big rocks in space. And you're seeing it here. It's an archaeological record of that period. So astronomers use these craters to figure out what actually happened back then. It's all part of how the solar system was formed. So this is really solar system astrophysics. So now I need to introduce you to a unit of distance, because we're now going to move out into the solar system. And it's called an astronomical unit. It's equal to the mean distance of Earth to the sun. Johannes Kepler, in the late 1500s, figured out the motions of the planets, and he could tell you what the distances to the planets were, for example, Jupiter. But he didn't know the absolute distance. He knew the relative distance, say, the distance relative to Mars or Earth. And one way to do that is through the astronomical unit. So relative to the Earth, the distance of Earth to the Sun. So what AUs. So we're going to work out AUs now. And let's just move out a little bit. Here's Mars. So Mars, the red planet, the god of war. Mars is fantastic. It's an amazing world, and we've sent robots there. At Caltech, was part of the Jet Propulsion Lab, and I got to watch some of these missions being developed and built. It was truly a remarkable achievement to get there. One piece, they had to send back pictures. There's several rovers up now that are doing their work, and we know that from our spacecraft that are orbiting Mars, that they have these amazing geology. Here's a picture of Valles Marineris, which is a great canyon. You can see that here. It's this big gash going across Valles Marineris. This is something 10 times bigger than the Grand Canyon. It's just tremendously huge. Let's move you now a little bit. We're now tens of AU away. Okay, so these are the outer planets. I just pushed them onto one slide, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But these things are getting further and further and further away. Now we know, because of the cosmic distance ladder, that these things are gas giants. They're giants, far, 1,000 times bigger than the Earth. Because we know that they're far away. And because they're gas giants, because they're so big, they have so much gravitational attraction, so much gravity, that they can hold their primordial gas, which is hydrogen. So they're full of hydrogen, unlike the terrestrial planets like Mars and Earth and Venus. Full of hydrogen. So now I want to move outside of the solar system. You can see this is very beautiful. And we've sent spacecraft to all of these planets and beyond. And soon we're going to be sending the spacecraft to Pluto. You'll see that in a few years here. So now we introduce you to another unit. We now have to talk about light years, because we're now going to move out of the solar system, and AUs just doesn't do it anymore. Distances are becoming vast. But we astronomers actually don't use light years. We use a unit called a parsec. Okay? And a parsec, I'm going to show you why we use parsecs later. But for now, you just have to take my word for it. One parsec equals 3.26 light years. So I'm going to start quoting things in parsecs, and occasionally I might mention light years. For the first object, I will use light years, because it's the only one I think I know the answer in light years. Otherwise, my brain thinks in parsecs. So let's move out to what we call the solar neighborhood. So this is a familiar sight to you. Here's the Southern Cross, right here. And one way to find the Southern Cross very easily is to use these pointer stars, right? You go, oh, there they are. Oh, there's the Southern Cross. For me, this is still a very exotic thing in the sky, so I love to look at the Southern Cross. You can't see it from the Northern Hemisphere. These two stars, so here are the pointers, but this star in particular is Alpha Centauri. That's the nearest star. Alpha Centauri is some 4 light years away, 4.26 or so. Okay, so it takes 4 light years. 4 years for light to travel from Alpha Centauri to us here on the Earth. And that's one block away. That's just down the road. It's 4 years. If we were to send our fastest spacecraft right now, Voyager is our fastest spacecraft, it would take something like 80,000 years to get there. But, you know, we do need to speed things up. Alpha Centauri is a double system. In fact, it might even be there's a third object here shown in that. So this is a little bit different from the sun. It's a very similar star. But it does have a neighbor, so you'd always have another sun in the sky. Alpha Cent. So that's about one parsec away. Okay, so there's an easy one. It's one parsec. Let's move on. So we've looked at Alpha Cent. And now I'm going to move over to, which is near Taurus. Sorry. Alpha Cent and Centaurus. I'm now going to move to the Pleiades, which is near Taurus, and then I'm going to move to Orion. So here's the Pleiades. Pleiades are fantastic. So these things are, you know, something like, I don't know, 100 parsecs away. So now we're moving out. And you're looking at a little stellar nursery, you know, 10 million year old stars. They're just little babies. But they're old enough, they're sort of at the preteen stage. They're old enough that they're getting precocious and they're blowing away their birth cloud. You can see some of the birth cloud. That's what all this fuzz is. That's what they were born inside of. That's the actual gas and fuel that made them. But they're very windy. They have lots of winds and they're blowing. They're very active. And soon they'll just be a bunch of stars. Little star cluster, that's the Pleiades. And over time, all the stars are gonna move and they'll just disperse into the Milky Way. That'll take, you know, hundreds of millions of years for that to happen. Now I've moved to another famous object in the sky. This is Orion. So Orion is now 500 parsecs away. Okay, so we've started out with Cent 1. Now we're 500 times further. This is a beautiful picture it's a combination of the Chandra X-ray Space Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope and the Infrared Spitzer Space Telescope, all three of them. This is a stellar nursery that's in action. Right? So these are all baby stars. They're all being born. They're far more massive than when you saw it in the Pleiades. These are big stars. There they are. So it's just fantastic. And the reason it looks so beautiful is because part of the cloud is being blown away. Peer inside, and you can see this really bright spot. There's you know thousands of stars in there, just going at it, all little baby stars. So Orion's one of the most amazing places in the Milky Way. Now as we move out, we're now getting to 1,000 parsecs. This is called the Crab Nebula. So this was a star that exploded in something like 1,000 years ago, in fact. The Crab Nebula, and you can see it's just amazing. This massive star exploded, and a little bit while later, we look at it, you see all of the refuse and the ejecta, as we call it, streaming out. So 1,000 parsecs is now a kiloparsec. Okay, so I'll be using kiloparsecs. We're moving out. Here's one of my favorite exploding stars. This is a supernova. Remnant called the Cas A. I love Cas A. Notice all the beautiful colors. You saw here and here. My pictures from now on are going to show you multicolors. It's not just because it's pretty. Each color is telling you something different, energetics. So I like to think of this as multi-wavelength or multi-physics. Okay, so each color is giving you a different window into the energetics of this object. This star blew up. And it blew up in the Milky Way, down in the Milky Way. It was never observed by the ages, never seen. So it was only recently discovered with our space telescopes. And you can see it's just fantastic, amazing. It's beautiful shells that this is ejected, that's slamming into, you know, the birth cloud where it was born. And it's creating these shocks. So energized molecules, energized atoms. And each one of those gives off a different frequency of light. So that's what I mean when you're looking at a different window of energetics. This is now we're moving out to tens of kiloparsecs. This is 47 Tuck. This is a globular cluster. Globular clusters, they have something like 10,000 to 100,000 stars, all packed densely into a little space. It's only about, oh, maybe 30 parsecs, 50 parsecs across in diameter. And yet it has almost 100,000 stars. There they are. This thing is not so colorful, though, but this is a color picture. That's because every object here has about the same physics going on. It has the same age, the same sort of stage in its life. These are all ancient, old stars. Globular clusters, which hover around the Milky Way, are the oldest objects in the universe. Something like 13 billion year old object. 11 to 13, we're not really sure on the upper end. But they're the oldest things, and they just hover out there, and I think of them as the elders of the Milky Way. And there they are, and they'll stay there forever. They'll slowly dim over 100 billion years, and they'll become very dark, but they'll still be there, doing this thing. Now we've moved outside of the Milky Way to our nearest galaxy, if you like. This is the satellite galaxy, the Large Imaginary Cloud. This is what it looks like if you have a nice telescope. You can see it's quite beautiful, but complex. You know, it's not symmetric. It's what we call bar shaped, so it's got this sort of linear feature. Now we are at about 300 kiloparsecs. 300, right? And so we would love to know, you know, the exact distance of this thing. And so we're going to use some techniques to show you later. One of them is called the Cepheid variables. So we can determine the distance. But you can see this thing isn't just a little ball. You don't determine one distance, you have to determine many. In fact, this thing has some crazy shape in space. You know, it's three-dimensional. It has an amazing star formation region right there called the Tarantula Nebula, 30 Doradus. That's far more massive than anything I showed you. You could fit, you know, many Orion nebulas inside of that thing. It's just another amazing object. Now we're moving now to, this is our sister galaxy. This is the Andromeda galaxy. Now we're getting close to 1,000 kiloparsecs. This is about 700 or so. 700,000 kiloparsecs. 700 kiloparsecs, sorry. I get confused. The Andromeda, one of the most incredible galaxies because it's so close. It is actually that close, but this is what we think the Milky Way looks like. This is truly a sister galaxy. They're about the same size, the Milky Way and Andromeda. And they're so close to each other, they're gravitationally bound. So we, Milky Way and Andromeda, are actually falling towards each other in the hole. And someday we're actually going to crash into each other. It's going to be an amazing cosmic collision. I'll show you some cosmic collisions in a second that are happening out there. But the thing about this collision that might amaze you is that when it happens, no star from the Milky Way or the Andromeda are actually going to hit each other. It's going to pass right through. Okay? That's how much vast empty space there is in the galaxy. Nevertheless, each galaxy will change its shape forever. They'll be ripped apart if you could step back and look at them. And then slowly they'll do a little dance. They'll orbit each other, and then they'll pass through each other again. Each time they do that, they'll change shape, and eventually they'll merge into one big galaxy. It'll probably be a ball at that point. It won't be this beautiful spiral structure that you see. I love Andromeda. I'm studying this now with a student, and we're using infrared wavelengths. You can see this is the same galaxy, but now this is an optical picture, what your eyes would see. And if I move to the infrared, which is a little bit longer wavelength, this is now heat. We're getting different physics, right? That's what these colors are telling you. And you can see it's very different. And that's because with the infrared, we can see through a lot of this gas and dust. You know these black lanes? That's blocking the light. You don't know what's going on. But here, it's telling you that those black lanes are now actually bright. See these bright lanes? This is where stars are being formed. So these are Orions, and there are 30 Doradus. They're in these big arms, big spiral arms. So it's one way to actually peel away the layers of Andromeda to figure out what it's actually doing. The big picture here is that we want to understand the life cycle of M31, how it's actually formed, how it lives, and then how it dies. You might notice some other fuzzies in here. This is this is called Messier M110. The Andromeda also is known as M31. It comes from a catalog, Charles Messier, from the 18th century. And he went through all these fuzzies in the sky, and the number was M31. This is M110. M110 is a little satellite of Andromeda. This is another little satellite, this little guy here. Big galaxies like the Milky Way and Andromeda have lots of little neighbors, little satellites that hang out, they do little orbits. That's their entourage. And if you could look closer, you would see a lot of their clusters too, lots of them around Andromeda. Let's keep going. So Andromeda and the Milky Way are part of what's known as the local group. The local group has, 50-ish galaxies. Most of them are little. They're little dwarfy-looking things. But they're all gravitationally bound. So we all have the same fate. And I told you these two are going to crash into each other. All of them are. They're all going to merge someday. So this is the smallest kind of, we'll call it, group of galaxies. So now we're moving beyond that. And now we have to introduce you to my final metric, which is a megaparsec. So megaparsec is a million parsecs. Okay, so now you're now in the realm of the galaxies. Galaxies are megaparsecs away. Andromeda is about 0.7. Okay, so now I'm going to move to a galaxy, one of my favorites. I just published a paper on this guy called M83, also known as the Southern Pinwheel. You can see this from your backyard. You have a little telescope. It's one of the most beautiful galaxies. It has this beautiful spiral structure, just fantastic. This is called a bar. So it's got linear features, it's got spiral arms. You can see all the little dust lanes. Remember the dust lanes, that's where stars are forming. Those are stellar nurseries. And the bright stuff, those are the massive stars that have already formed and blown out their birth clouds. But I would say this picture, it's very obscure. There's a little bit, it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. So we move to different wavelengths. This is the paper that I published. And I'm showing you now, I'm showing 5 different colors. And up here in the blue, and that's what you're seeing here, that's a color combination. Up here in the blue, that's the ultraviolet wavelength. Okay? The ultraviolet, those are higher energies. The ultraviolet is giving you the most massive, the most energetic stars. They're the youngest. They live a few million years, and then they blow up. They explode, and they throw their material out into the interstellar medium. It's like hydrogen and helium and carbon and oxygen and iron. Throws it out there, and then forms clouds, and then new stars are formed from that. So there's this cycle that goes on. And that's what this is telling you. As we move down here, I'm moving to the near-infrared, so this is just a little bit beyond our visual wavelength, into the mid-infrared. This is what we call the thermal mid-infrared, thermal infrared. So this is heat coming from, you're not now seeing the mass of stars, you're seeing their birth clouds, okay? And so this is the sort of physics that we can gather from this, is the mass of stars. This tells you, these wavelengths tell you something about the dust. These wavelengths, these color tells you something about the interstellar medium, the molecules, the gas, the dust. And this tells you, this wavelength here, which is the near infrared, tells you something about the backbone, the stars, the old stars that hold the whole thing together. And that's what you see here. We also use another technique called spectroscopy. This is a sort of spectroscopy you're seeing. This is me using different wavelengths, but we can look at it in much greater detail when we spread things out using a prism or a grating. Okay, so now we're moving out just a little bit further. This thing was, by the way, about 3 megaparsecs. This thing is a little bit further, maybe about 3.5 megaparsecs. What do you think that is? That looks like a galaxy that's exploding. And in some sense, it is. This is called M82. There's those M number things. M82, I don't believe, has a proper name. And that's because if you were to look at it visually, when Charles Messier looked at it in the 18th century, it was just a little blob. It was not remarkable, so nobody gave it a name. It doesn't have a cool name, but in fact, it's an amazing galaxy, because when we look at it in other wavelengths, this is what it's doing. It looks like it's exploding. The galaxy is right here. Okay. It's a disk galaxy, slightly inclined, so it has a cigar shape. But look at all this stuff over here. You're looking at X-rays, you're looking at infrared, you're looking at shock lines. I'm shocked that the gas is flowing out from here, hitting stuff out here, the intergalactic medium, and fluorescing and heating up and so forth. So what's happening is that this thing is what we call starburst galaxy. It's forming a number of stars at a rate much higher than, say, the Milky Way, so about 10 times higher. It's not a very big galaxy, but there's a lot of these stars in here. So much so that it's blowing. Remember we saw Orion blowing its birth belt? Well, this thing's literally blowing the galaxy away. And that's what's happening here. Sometimes we call these things fountains, but I don't think that's quite appropriate. An exploding galaxy, starburst galaxy, is something that I like to work on. Now we're moving about 10 megaparsecs away. Beautiful galaxy. This is the Whirlpool galaxy. M51. This is something you see from the northern hemisphere. And M51 now, I think this is the first one I'm showing you where two galaxies are interacting. And because they're interacting, there's two galaxies here. There's this one, this beautiful pinwheel, and there's this one. This is an old galaxy, and you can tell because it's colors. It's got this sort of orange color to it. And it's also got some dust lanes that are coming from this guy. So these two are crashing into each other, but they're doing it in a gentle fashion. So much so that this thing is generating waves that move across the disk of this thing and creating these beautiful, tight spiral arms. So this, what we call a grand design spiral, the very shape that you're seeing, that's beautiful, all these, you know, these old massive stars and the dust lanes, the very shape is due to the fact that you're getting a gravitational resonance because of this interaction. Absolutely fantastic. Now I'm moving out to about 17 megaparsecs. This one is 10. You're looking at a galaxy cluster. So these are some of the most massive things in the known universe. This is the Virgo cluster. You can see that from the southern hemisphere. Thousands of galaxies. Right? So I showed you about the cluster, you know, hundreds of thousands of stars. This is now thousands of galaxies. Each one has 100 million. Each one, at least some of these are bigger than you can see. These are some of these are massively huge, some of them are tiny. And we know that because we know the distance. We know the shape of these things thanks to the cosmic distance ladder. The Virgo galaxy, this thing is so big and massive that now we need the local group, Andromeda, Milky Way, the Sun, we're falling into this thing. Yeah, it'll take a while before we fall into it completely, but this is where we're going, if you're wondering. Here's another cluster. This is called the Norman cluster. This one, the reason I wanted to show you this, we're now moving out to 70 megaparsecs. The reason I'm going to show you this is because look at all the stars. See these stuff in the background? That's the Milky Way. We're actually looking through the Milky Way in the Norman cluster, which is in the Milky Way. And we're looking to what's behind it. What's behind it is this tremendous cluster of galaxies. It's so big, it's got a special name besides the Norman galaxy cluster. It's called the Great Attractor because it's so massive that Virgo is falling into this thing. But this isn't all of it. I'm only showing you a little piece of it. We think that the Great Attractor isn't just one galaxy cluster, but many in a chain forming what we call superclusters. Now, one thing I want to point out is notice that they're all kind of this yellowish-orange color. These are not newish galaxies. They're kind of old. They evolved. They're not very old. When you see this sort of orangey-yellowish color, that means there aren't going to be stars that are forming. They're old. They've been around for a long time. But when you start to see colors like this guy, a little bit of red, a little bit of blues, that means they're forming stars. They're star forming. Now we're going to move out just beyond 100 megaparsecs. This is now the step. I'm showing you a compact group of galaxies. I showed you another one that was the local group, us, but this now is more spectacular. This practices a compact group known as Stefan's Quintet. Stefan's Quintet is a number of galaxies. They're so close to each other that they're interacting. And they're causing these gravitational tides and resonances. Remember, we talked about that with the whirlpool galaxies. Well, now this is happening, but it's much more complex. So you're not forming these beautiful spiral galaxies. It's a little bit messy now. But when you are forming, you know, lots of stars, because look at all those different colors. See those colors? That means star formation. That means galaxy is evolving. For me, that's always a good thing. It shows that the universe is vibrant and it's alive. I want to point out this green blob there. That green blob, that's not a galaxy. That's in between the galaxies. And it's green because it's giving off a shock line that's in the mid-infrared. And that shock is because these galaxies are slamming into each other, and the stuff that's in between them is in the way. And it's getting heated up, and it's spewing out emissions. You can't see this with your eye. This is something in another wavelength. And this is also shown here. This is a paper that was published a couple of years ago by one of my colleagues, where they studied this. And now they use spectroscopy, mid-infrared spectroscopy, and they were actually able to trace this shock. It's called an intergalactic medium shock. So it's as big as a galaxy. You can see that how huge it is. But it's just gas. There's no stars. There's no nothing there. It would look just empty to you. But we can use infrared wavelengths and spectroscopy to actually figure out the physics of this shock wave. This is an example of what astronomers are doing today. So now we're going to move out even further. We've now gone to 140 megaparsecs. I'm showing you a real freak. These are fairly rare. It's called a cartwheel galaxy. And this is due to a head-on collision. So you know galaxies are crashing into each other. You've seen that. But now what happens when one slams right through the middle of another one? Okay. So this guy went right through it. What it did is that this was a nice spiral galaxy. Maybe it looked like M83 a little bit. But when it went through it, it created the shock wave. And the shock wave was symmetric. And it shocked the interstellar medium. When I say by shocking, it means you compress the gas. Okay? You don't just let gravity do its gentle thing. You're pushing on it. And as you compress the gas, you start to form stars. That's the key to forming stars, is you got to squish the gas down. So it's squishing it down in this big symmetric ring. And so you're now seeing, remember what we were talking about, the colors? These are all the massive baby stars that are forming. It's forming in this ring. And there's multiple rings, and there's spokes. Here's this thing. In the middle has rings, these multiple rings. And you know they're at different ages, different masses, there's different physics, as you see different colors. Incredible. It doesn't happen very often. When it does, it's amazing. Here's another type of disturbed galaxy. This is called the tadpole, for obvious reasons. We've got this nice little tadpole tail. This is from a paper that I published a few years ago. And what's happened is, this is also a galaxy that's undergone a tidal interaction with another galaxy. But instead of ripping it apart or creating rings, it just pulled one of its outer spiral arms, just pulled it out. That's all. And that's what it's doing. But what's interesting, I started this thing using infrared wavelengths, is that there are these big, massive star formation regions. You can just see that with these little red blobs. And they're here, and they're here. And these were all induced by these shock waves that were traveling through the interstellar medium. So again, we're studying the life cycle of galaxies and stars. Sometimes we want to get a little, we're cheating a little bit. We're like, well, let's go look at galaxies that have been disturbed or shocked, because it speeds things up. That's what we like to do. That's the tadpole. There's a beautiful Hubble Space Telescope picture of, now you're seeing the crime in its act. Right? So now we're seeing a galaxy that's just punched through another galaxy. Again, these are rare, but it does happen. So we've now moved several hundred megaparsecs away. And at this point, I now want to leave the what I call the local
the local universe. We'll be moving to the distant universe. Between our local universe, which is about 1,000 megaparsecs. Okay? At about 1,000, you know, you have these beautiful galaxies. They form this beautiful grand structure. I'm going to show you at the end what we call the web. As we move further and further away, the galaxies are getting smaller and smaller, little blobs. We're now going back in time. Okay? And so we're moving to the early universe. So as we go back, as we go in distance, we're going early. So I'll sometimes refer to this as the early universe. And you're looking at it here. This is called the ultra-deep field image that comes from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's probably the deepest picture we have of the universe. It's just a pencil beam. Just, you know, peered off as far as they could go. Just many, many, Hubble just kept looking at it, you know, over many years and built up this picture that goes deeper and deeper and deeper. The things that are fuzzy that you see here, in fact, are in the local universe. They're not that far away. They're only a few hundred megaparsecs away. But the little blob, the little tiny little blobs in here, those are in the early universe. Here's an example. So here's our ultra deep field picture. Here's some of the nearby fuzzies. But if you look next to them, you can see they're different colors. They're different colors because they're by the time we receive the light from these galaxies, they have completely shifted their wavelengths. So you're looking at real ultraviolet wavelengths that are now shifted in wavelength because of the redshift, okay, the cosmic redshift. It's now shifting into the optical wavelengths that are color sheets. And here are some of these things that are at some of the highest redshifts known. Back to when the universe was only a couple billion years old. Here's a black and white picture of what some of these guys look like. Thanks to the Hubble, we can actually resolve some of that. You can see they're very blobby. They're very weird. They're not like galaxies in our local universe. That's because these things are young. You know, when the universe was young, there was a lot more gas and dust in those days. And there was a lot, and the universe was smaller, too. Much more compact. So they're all interacting. They're all, something's happening to them. So this is an idea of what's happening in the distant universe. There's another way to do this. We can use nearby galaxy clusters. So I showed you the Norman cluster, I showed you the Virgo. Here's another cluster called Abel 1689. It's not that far away, but it's massive. And because it's massive, it does this very interesting thing. It changes the light. When light goes through it from distant galaxies, it changes that light. It actually stretches it. It's called lensing. And you can see some of that lensing. That's these arcs. If you look very closely, you see an arc here, arc there, here's an arc, here's an arc, here's an arc, see an arc there. So these are galaxies that are behind this cluster. And some of them are the most distant. Because not only does this thing stretch the light a little bit, it's a little arc so you can identify them, but it amplifies them. Okay, just like a telescope. So this thing is a telescope in a way. So it makes these things 10 to 50 times brighter. Normally we wouldn't be able to see them, but with lensing, we can see them. So we identify the little arcs, and then we can go and point our spectrograph with our largest, you need the biggest telescopes that we have on Earth. You go look at these things, and lo and behold, they have the largest redshifts, they're the most distant, some of the most distant, earliest galaxies known, gravitational lensing. Fantastic method. Okay, so I now took you to the very edges of the universe, and I'm going to tell you a little bit how we did this. So we're going to talk about how we do this measuring distances. And again, we're going to be using things that you see on this chart, things like what we use parallax, and we use stars, and we use Cepheids, and so forth. First, I want to go through very quickly powers of 10. So let's move back to thinking about size scale. So powers of 10. So we have, you know, you and I are about a meter in size. Small dwellings are 10 meters. We're now going to multiply it by 10. You can see how things work. Large buildings are about 100 meters in size. A village might be 1,000 meters, and a city about 10,000. So at that point, we're going to start to move into kilometers. So countries and continents might be 1,000 kilometers across. Diameter Earth of something like 10,000 kilometers. Okay, so we've gone through what we we'd say four orders of magnitude. Okay? And then the moon, a little nearby neighbor, that's about a million kilometers. The inner solar system, you know, Venus, Earth, Mars, 10 to the 8. Okay, so now we're at 100 million kilometers. The greater solar system, so as we look out towards Neptune, Pluto, and beyond, we're talking about, you know, 10 billion kilometers. At this point, I can't really say what they are, but we just use the order of magnitude. A light year is about 10 to 13 kilometers. So now we're in the realm of the stars. The nearest star, something like 10 to 14 kilometers, and we don't know that's a parsec. The Milky Way is something like, you know, now we have to jump three orders of magnitude. It's about 10 to 17 kilometers. And we know that we're talking about kiloparsecs in size. So the Milky Way, and then this diameter might be something like 20, 25 kiloparsecs in diameter. The local group of galaxies. Now we're talking about megaparsecs, 10 to the 19th. Some really big numbers. The Virgo galaxy cluster is 10 to 21 kilometers away. You know, that's tens of megaparsecs. And then there's the local universe, 1,000 megaparsecs. Okay, so this is what I study. We can resolve these things. You know, this is local. This is what I would call the current universe. Okay? This is what the universe has come to. The local universe, that's like 10 to 22. And then, just another factor of 10, we've moved into the great beyond. 10, so this is the sort of thing that we're talking about, 10 to the 23 kilometers, when we're moving back in time. So here's the easiest thing we can do, and the most accurate, and that's radar ranging. Right? Radar ranging, we just send a pulse, a radar pulse off to the nearest planet. And, you know, and then we wait for its return, and we know the speed of light is very high precision, and we've got the distance. And, you know, we might use a great radio telescope like this to do that. This is called the Parkes Radio Telescope, also known as the DISH. In the north, you might use the Arecibo Telescope, which is a crater that's in Puerto Rico. It's the largest radio dish in the world. Okay, now, you can do that out to Jupiter. Maybe you can get to Saturn. But beyond that, we have to use other methods. We're going to use trigonometric parallax. So this is very powerful. You can use this, especially if you put a spacecraft in space and use this method. You can get out to about 500 parsecs. And in the future, we might push that a little bit more. So this method is very accurate, out to hundreds of parsecs. And it's very simple. You use the orbit of Earth. Okay, so when you're on one side of the sun, you look at a nearby star, and you look at it with respect to other stars, background stars. Okay? And then when you're on the other side, you know, 6 months later, you now look at that same star, and it would appear to have moved with respect to the background stars. That's just parallax, right? You can do that now, looking at the screen, just by blinking your eyes. It's very accurate. Hard to do. I actually don't like this kind of astronomy because it requires too much patience and precision. And you know, I'm an order of magnitude guy. I can do things in factors of 10, and maybe on a good day factors of 2. But you know, this is way beyond that. So true parallax. Now I want to introduce you to the concept of standard candles. Okay, so this is how everything else really works. So standard candle. What that means is the observed brightness and the intrinsic luminosity. Okay, observe brightness, that's what you measure. The intrinsic luminosity, that's something you need to know. If you know those two, you can get the distance. And it's through this thing, it's called the distance modulus. So here's the distance d, and here's little m is the observed brightness of the object, the flux, and big m is the absolute luminosity of the object, or what we call the absolute magnitude. These are magnitudes. The distance of modulus. You can do this method if you know what the intrinsic luminosity is. And we do for stars, and we do for planets here. Nebulae, we do for subnovae, early type galaxies. There's various things we call their standard candles, and we know this through study decades now of what they are. I'll show you simply with stars. So here's what's called a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Okay, so on this axis we have color. Okay, V minus V, the color of a star. And on this axis we have its luminosity. And what we've noticed, this is really old-fashioned astronomy now, something that I learned when I was a kid, is that stars, they bunch up like this. And it depends on what kind of star they are and where they are in their life. So what we call main sequence stars, or just normal stars, they live on this track right here. They span this color range and this luminosity range. So when we take a spectrum of a star, okay, we can look at it based on its spectrum, based on its absorption lines, the kinds of lines it has, the chemistry that's in the star's atmosphere. We can say, I know what that is. That's a G star, a G type star like the sun. G stars live over here. Okay? So G star has a particular color. And then we go over here, we know, it has this luminosity of one sun. Based on that, and the observed brightness, we can then determine the distance. We do that through the distance modulus. Some stars are not little main sequence stars. They're also known as dwarf stars, by the way. These are all dwarf stars. Well, main sequence stars, we call them because of these guys. These are the giants. Okay? What happens is a little dwarf star, at the end of its life, it's used up its fuel. It starts to expand, and it becomes a giant star, and it moves off this way. And it moves this way because it's getting redder and redder and redder, and it goes up because it's getting more and more luminous. So these are the most luminous stars that we know of, but they're the giants. Supergiants up here are the most luminous. And we can see supergiants to the end of the Milky Way. We can see them in other nearby galaxies, like Andromeda. So we can use supergiants to actually figure out how far away the galaxy is. So this is one way that we do that. This is real old-fashioned astronomy. Now, I'm going to show you this excessively complicated plot, because now we're going to move beyond the old-fashioned stuff. This is the new stuff. All kinds of methods we use. We use variable stars. We use supernovae. We use masers. I just wanted to show you that because all of these things are linked and they're part of the ladder. So let me just show you one of them. This is probably the most important one of the bunch. These are called periodic variables. They are Aurora Lyra and Cepheids. And they get this name because of the original star that was looked at had that name. And they realized that these things are actually special. So they're called Cepheid types of stars. And what they do is they pulsate. You look at them and they change the brightness. It's almost like they're breathing. They go in and out, in and out. They're pulsing. So their outer surface is actually expanding. And then it contracts. And as it contracts, it gets hot. Gets more luminous than it expands. And it keeps doing that. And it turns out that only stars with a certain mass do that. And because of that, that means they're a standard candle. They all act the same way. So here's an example of a light curve. On this axis is the apparent brightness of what we see, what we measure. On this axis is the time in days. You can see it goes down and up, very periodic, sine wave looking thing. Describe that very carefully. But there are different kinds of Cepheids. One thing that we have to recognize that we have essentially three kinds. We have the type 1 classical Cepheids. They're called classical because this is what Edwin Hubble used in the 1920s. He used the classical ones. These are the most luminous, as you can see on this diagram. They're up here. They're the most luminous, they're the easiest to see. He used these to figure out how far Andromeda. These are Cepheid variables, classical, but they're a little bit fainter ones. Fainter ones are good because there's a lot more of them, but you need more powerful telescopes. And then finally, there is what's known as the RR Lyra. So these are the faintest ones. They're way down there. They're six orders of magnitude fainter than the classical Cepheids. You can't use these very far away, so these are strictly for the Milky Way. But they give you the most accurate value, so they're highly sought after objects are Lyras. This is one of the best ways to figure out how far nearby galaxies are, as demonstrated here. This was from a press release only a few months ago. So this is some of the most press-worthy astronomy that goes on right now. Are distance measurements to, say, the large magellanic cloud. So this is using Cepheids, and here you can see, so this is and this is a result showing luminosity on this axis and period of variability. And you can see now, this is real data, you can see that there's this beautiful correlation going across these different types of variables, different types of Cepheids, and the different luminosities. You can see it's a very tight correlation. This little scatter in there that you see kind of determines how well the accuracy you can figure things out. Cepheid variables. Okay, so Cepheid variables, we use these things out to, oh, I don't know, tens of megaparsecs. So the, you know, just a few. Out to, you know, Virgo Galaxy cluster. At that point, they're too faint. You can't use them anymore. You need to do something else. You can't use stars. What you will use is the galaxy itself. Now we're going to use these methods over here. And I'm going to tell you about this one, the Tully-Fisher relation, one of my favorite, and then we'll end up with the Hubble law. So the Tully-Fisher model, this is how you use the galaxy itself. You measure the rotation of the disk. So galaxies aren't just sitting there, they're rotating. The Milky Way is rotating, Andromeda is rotating. And when you measure them, and you measure their gas, their hydrogen gas. You know, this is the fuel that makes stars. You measure the hydrogen gas, and you notice that, you know, you see this rotation. You see one end going one way and one end going the other way. And you get this sort of this Batman-looking curve. And all this is showing you is that that's what the rotation looks like. And if you correlate that rotation with the brightness of the galaxy itself, okay, what I would call the backbone of the galaxy, or its stellar content, its stellar mass. If you correlate them, it turns out that you have a standard candle. Okay, so you've got rotation rate on this axis. So this is all different galaxies that have, you know, whatever rotation they have. And on this axis is the luminosity. So you measure the rotation, and you go to this curve here, you go read down, and you've got its luminosity. And that's the standard candle used in the distance modulus. Boom, you got the distance of the galaxy. So that's the Tully-Fisher relation. You got to be able to, for it to work, you've got to be able to measure the hydrogen, right? And it's got to be a disky galaxy that's rotating. I showed you some example of galaxies that have been disturbed. You know, they're not rotating. They're doing all kinds of stuff. That's not going to work. Some galaxies are ancient. They're old. They don't have a disk anymore, they're just a big ball, right? They don't do this, so you can't use this method for some galaxies, but about half of them, you can use it. So that's the Tully-Fisher method. Here's an example of some real data. You can see the various scattering in there. These things aren't as accurate as trigonometric parallax or stellar parallax, but they are much more accurate than, let's say, using the Hubble law, which I'll show you now. The Hubble law, though, really is, it's nature's gift to astronomers. And it's like, it's very interesting, this is like the first part of the cosmic distance ladder that was studied, and yet it's the last one, really, it's the last component of the ladder. And it all comes down to looking at galaxies and noticing that when you look at their redshift, galaxies are always sort of moving away from us. And it turns out that's just the expanding universe. So the further away the galaxy is, the higher its redshift is. And that's, and of course, that's the Hubble law. And we measure, and again, we use, the most important thing that we use for the Hubble law is Cepheids, because we measure the Hubble law using nearby galaxies. We really can't calibrate this thing with very distant galaxies. Although I'll show you that of late, this garnered a Nobel Prize recently using supernovae to calibrate the Hubble. So this is a sort of a state of the art of the Hubble law. So here's the Hubble law: is that the redshift is related to the distance by a constant called the Hubble constant. Where this is the recessional velocity of the galaxy, the redshift, and this is the distance, and this is the Hubble constant, and this turns out to be the latest, greatest number. It's about 71 plus or minus 4 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And you can see the data here. This is the sort of accuracy that it has. And as we go further and further away, so let's see, let's look at our distance scale. We have 100 megaparsecs. So, you know, in here is the sort of the galaxies that I work on, the ones that are quite beautiful. Then as you move out to the end of the local universe, the errors are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then we can go out to about 700. So that's it. And we're using supernovae to calibrate out here. That little red box there, that's what Hubble worked with. That was it. That was Andromeda, maybe a couple other galaxies that he looked at. And he determined that his O constant, it was something like 100 in those days, 100 or 200. It had such a fantastic uncertainty that, that you know, it showed that there was something was going on. I want to finish up with the cosmic light. We use the Hubble constant. We use all these standard candles and distance measurements to do this, to construct the big picture. Okay, so the big picture is this. It's the web of galaxies. Now we're just talking about, now we're not looking at galaxies as some beautiful object. They're just a dot. And if we put all those dots down, you get this. You get the web of galaxies. And we see structure on all scales. It's almost, it's what we call fractaling. And this is this is a simulation. I'll show you some real data. This is comes from the Drone Digital Sky Survey. You're looking at, we're down here, we're looking out. This is getting further and further away. You're looking at a little slice of the universe. And you can see it has these different structures. We call these walls, bubbles. There's some voids in here, voids where there's no galaxies. And they're basically forming a bubble. If I could now spread this out in three dimensions, you see those bubbles. Walls. It's quite beautiful. This is what it looked like in the 1980s. When I was just getting started, when I was a young student, this was the state of the art. And this is what the first pictures came from the cosmic web. And this is called the stick man, because it looks like a stick man out there. Right? And it turns out that's just that's a bias that comes from the way we measure things. It's not real. And then this is with the Sloan Sky Survey. This is moving out further. You can see these great, called great walls, and bubbles and voids. And this is just, you know, a few hundred microparsecs away. This just keeps going and going and going. Here's a project that I worked on when I was, just a few years ago. We mapped the sky using redshifts, using the Hubble law, and we constructed this, which is a beautiful view of the cosmic web. So from here to there, this is one of my last slides. I want to show you the earliest picture, the early universe, the earliest snapshot of what the universe looked like when it was only 300,000 years old. This is it. This comes from the WMAP, which comes from the COBE, springs from the COBE spacecraft. These were spacecraft that were launched in space, and all they did was microwave background. It microwaves. They measured the entire sky, and they got this. This is what the universe looked like when it was young. And what's important there is the fact that it doesn't look smooth, because if it were smooth, we wouldn't be here today. All galaxies, everything that has some clumpiness to it, right? All these structures we've been talking about, they come from this. They come from these little red things. These red blobs. These are not galaxies. These are not stars. These are concentrations in the space-time continuum where there's mass. Okay? This is the primordial material that created all the galaxies. Now watch this. Okay? This is the early universe. Now I'm going to show you the local universe. Okay? This is what we see today. Okay? This is the local universe. We go from this 13 billion years to that. In here, this is the Milky Way, it's in the way. That's why it gets front and center. We don't know what's behind this. But other parts of the Milky Way we can see through. These are all galaxies. Right? This is the cosmic web. Here's Virgo up here. You heard about Virgo, the Norma cluster lives down there. That's what it is. Everything in between is what astronomers.
astronomer study from here to there. Okay, so this is my last slide. Thanks to the distance ladder, the universe we know is really big. I don't know how to emphasize that. It's really big. It's complex, but it's elegant in the structure. You know, it's still got a lot of mysteries. You know, I haven't really dwelled on that, but you know, we don't really know anything. I'm willing to admit that. But it's fine, you know, it's part of the quest. And it's knowable because of science. So we launch our spacecraft and we take our pretty pictures, figure it out. There you go. Conference is